down here because I have a couple of books here that I want to recommend to you. And each time I do a lesson like this, I like to stir up your interest because we're just barely touching the hem of the garment, folks, in these topics. Here's a good little book that's really designed for junior high and high school level, which would probably be perfect for most of us in this subject. It's called Exploring Evolution, and it really hits it from a standpoint of both perspectives. They look at the evidence, and then they show you the evolutionary interpretation and the interpretation from the standpoint of intelligent design. Excellent book, Explore Evolution. There's a previous book that kind of preceded this one called Of Pandas and People that's very much like it. I don't know if you can even get it anymore. It's probably out of print. But this is a good little book. You can come up and take a look later. And then Darwin's Black Box, another excellent treatise by Michael Behe. This is a second edition of that book. You want to get the most recent edition if you're going to get this. And so you can come up and take a look. And by the way, this one is signed by Michael Behe. I saw him personally at the University of South Florida some few years ago. Excellent little book to which we'll be referring this evening. And I'm going to introduce several other books up here, which we'll also try to remember to put down there so you can take a look at them. I will also provide a bibliography. Clay will have that. We'll get it off my little thumb drive before I leave here. And it'll have all these books plus a host of others on it that you can refer to if you like to discuss this subject further. All right. Okay. It was a little slow on the draw there, Clay. Okay. One of the challenges with this series is there's a lot to talk about. So I don't wish to take very long by way of introduction. And so I say to all of you, thank you for being here. God bless you, and let's get to our lesson. I ought to be naming a bunch of people tonight for those of you that have come from other places. For those of you that are members here that haven't known me before, there's a lot of students I have in this audience here, my former students. And so it's an honor to have all of you here, those of you who were students of mine in the past, and of course everyone. Thank you for the privilege. And let's get right at our topic at hand. The other challenge I have is good teaching technique would say the first thing you do is you review last night's lesson. Wrong. We don't have time for that. It's recorded, so you can go look at it. Sorry for those of you that weren't here last night. There were some introductory lesson materials that you really need as a foundation, but we'll do our best to pick it up from here. Tonight, and I will tell you, those of you that weren't here, I like to call you my class because this is more like a lecture than it is a sermon. So I'm going to call you my class. Thank you for being here, class. It was not required attendance like it is where I teach. So I appreciate so much your being here. Tonight, we want to take the next step in our discovery process as we look at this general theme of what is more reasonable as we explain the evidence of the natural world. Tonight, our topic is designed at the microscopic level. I've entitled it The Signature in the Cell. So we're going to be looking down at the chemical level, ladies and gentlemen, my favorite subject of all time. If I'm given a second life, I'm going to come back and I'll be a biochemist. At this point, I'm a chemist. And I hope I can excite you to some small degree about chemistry. Because life, ladies and gentlemen, at the fundamental level, at the physical level, is chemistry. And it is the key. And you are privileged to have lived in the last 50 years. Because we've learned more about life at the chemical level in the last 50 years than in all the history of mankind prior to that. It truly has been a grand awakening. And that's what I want to talk to you about. All right. So far, so bad. Okay. We'll start with a couple of passages of Scripture. As I mentioned last night, when I do this series of lessons in a college lecture hall, we do not refer to the Bible at all. It's not necessary because God has given us a grand testimony in a different book. But let's start with this book since we're in a Bible setting here, in a church building setting. 1 Peter 3 verse 15 says, "Sanctify the Lord God in your hearts always, and always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear." That's a charge for us. If you're a believer in God, you need to be ready to defend that belief in God. So that's what this series is about. And I think you have much to appeal to from the natural world. Now the second passage, I don't know why this is so slow tonight, is Romans chapter 1. Let's take a look. Everybody, if you have your Bible, I'd like for you to open to this, because it is the theme passage for this series. I refer to it because it is a biblical passage that supports what I'm doing. And I don't want anybody to be offended that for the rest of the evening, we're not going to be referring to this book. We're going to be referring to what I call God's other book. But this book supports that approach. And Romans 1 verse 20 is one of the passages. So let's look at it again this evening. "For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead," or divinity, deity, some passages say, "so that they are without excuse." What that passage argues is that you can see God without being able to see Him. God is invisible, but you can see Him. How is that? By examining the things that are made. That's the famous argument from design, always the strongest argument for the existence of God as we look at the natural world, at least in this man's opinion. So that's what I'm going to be doing tonight and tomorrow night. We're going to make the argument from design, in this case, specifically at the microscopic level. Now, I also want to make this statement at the beginning. For many of you in this audience, it is simply not necessary for you to do this detailed a study of life at the microscopic level. It is sufficient for you, first, that this book says God created, and second, that you can look at a tree, and that's good enough. Or you can see a baby born, and that's good enough to convince you that God exists. If that's the case for you, God bless you. May I say to you, there are a host of people in our age for whom that is not sufficient, because they've become convinced that life came about by some other process that did not require God at all. And the very idea that you would bring God into the discussion is so foreign to some of these folks. They need more. So this series of lessons is not designed for people who are already convinced by what the Bible says. It does you no good, ladies and gentlemen, to quote Genesis 1 and other parts of the Bible to someone who doesn't even believe in God. That is of no value. You need to start farther back. And I love it to have the privilege to speak with an atheist or an agnostic and open to them God's book. Not this one. God's other book. So that's what I want to do for you tonight. And the reason I get as detailed as I do is because I've talked to many people in my life who need much more than just say, "Look at that tree. Why don't you believe in God?" That's not sufficient for a lot of folks. And what I'm here to tell you this evening is that it is as if God has opened up the Pandora's box of evidence for us in the last 50 years. And how anyone anymore can miss that there had to be a designer is beyond me. And I'm thrilled to have a privilege to talk just a little bit about the glorious creation that God has made. That's my introduction tonight. I'm putting this book away as we turn to God's other book. All right, I told you last night that there's an organization called SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, that is going on as we speak. They're searching the heavens for signs of intelligent life. This is their website. I introduced this last night, and on their website, one of the opening statements is this: SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, is an exploratory science. You see that? They claim to approach this scientifically, and I'm convinced they do. that seeks evidence of life, specifically intelligent life, in the universe by looking for some signature of its technology. So what are they looking for? And I see if I were doing this properly, I'd ask you, class, the ones of you that were here last night, because I know you remember everything I said. What signature are they looking for? They're looking for radio signals, right, class? Radio signals. Narrow band radio signals that contain information. And if they were to find such a thing, they would declare there's intelligent life out there. What if we received then a message from space that had a language in it that we could learn to decode and read? And by the way, is this on? Okay. It doesn't sound like it's on. But you can hear in the back? Okay. What if we got a signal from outer space with a language in it? I will tell you what would happen. Every newspaper in the country would have headlines. We have, for the first time in the history of mankind, discovered there's intelligent life out there in the universe. Well, I'm here to tell you there's signs of intelligent design right here on Earth, all around us, everywhere. Specifically tonight, I want to talk about the living cell. It is full of signs of design. Right here. You don't have to look out there. Right here on Earth. Including a language which we have learned to decode and read. We know exactly what it means, and that's part of my job tonight, to explain to you what that language means. It's in every cell in your body, and you have billions of cells. And it's being used at a phenomenal rate to do phenomenal things, which I'm going to explain to you just briefly tonight. Dr. Anthony Flew, to whom I referred last night, professor of philosophy, former atheist, in the year 2004 at the age of 80, made this statement. It now seems to me that the findings of more than 50 years of DNA research, that's the language right there, have provided materials for a new and enormously powerful argument to design. And so Dr. Flew, a former atheist, has become a believer, at least that there had to be a designer for DNA. He doesn't believe that could have come about by natural causes. It has a language in it, ladies and gentlemen. Does nature produce languages by itself? Don't think so. Research on DNA continues to this day to reveal signs of design, and my hope tonight is to give you little tastes of what we've learned. Anthony Flew said, "I have to go where the evidence leads." I hope at 80 years old I might still be willing to change my mind about something. I hope you will too. And this is pretty significant, wouldn't you say? That's a significant changing of your mind. He debated creationists for years and belittled them. Now he's become one. I love that. So where do we come from? There are only two possibilities. You either came about by natural causes or you came about by intelligent design. And you see the summary here. That's last night's lesson. I move on. There are only two choices. Tonight we're going to turn our attention to design at the microscopic level. And some of what I'm going to talk about comes from this interesting book called Signature in the Cell. Do you notice that word signature? Comes from the SETI website. They're looking for some signature of technology out there in outer space. Stephen Meyer, who wrote this book, says it's right here under your nose. That signature. It's in the cell. I highly recommend this book. Little thick, full of a lot of chemistry, but wonderful reading. Stephen Meyer's a great writer. He's a philosopher as well as a scientist, and he does the history of this subject, and he does a lot of detailed science in here. It's highly worth your time. So we're going to refer to this book a good bit. You'll notice the copyright date's 2009, so it's a fairly current book. And the question will be, class, as we look at this evidence, I'm going to show you tonight the chemical evidence that we have inside the cell, some of it. And then I'm going to ask you, which is a more reasonable explanation or interpretation of that evidence? Is it natural causes, the general theory of evolution, or is it intelligent design? Which is more reasonable? And that's about the best you can do in this case. Which does the preponderance of the evidence support? All right, here we go. I hope you're ready, because we're ready for a chemistry journey. And I will start out with this little booklet called Life Itself, Its Origin and Nature by Dr. Francis Crick. Now, again, if you were my class, I would be asking you who Dr. Crick is. Dr. Francis Crick received the Nobel Prize in 1953 for the discovery of the structure of DNA, along with Dr. James Watson. Watson and Crick. You want to read an interesting, fascinating historical story? Read this book about Watson and Crick. It's fascinating. Those guys are given credit with uncovering the structure of DNA. Can you believe that they just did the last little piece of it and as if they got full credit? That happens a lot in science. People build on the work of 100 other people, and then they're the ones that kind of tip it over the top and they get all the credit. You can be assured that Francis Dr. Crick and Dr. Watson don't deserve as much credit as they get. But they certainly know a lot about life. And so he wrote a little book called Life Itself. And the material I'm about to share with you came directly from that book. In fact, we're going to look at page 72. Life as we know it on earth. And can I pause there a minute? Life as we know it on earth. People, we don't know of any other life. Anywhere. So when I say tonight, life as we know it, will you please understand that's the only life anybody knows anything about? There are people that make up stories about how other life forms could exist, but nobody knows of any such thing other than carbon-based, water-based life. That's what we've got. Back to the quote. Life as we know it on earth appears as a synthesis of two macromolecular systems. I just lost you, didn't I? Two systems of huge molecules. And here they are. First of all, there are the proteins. Crick says there are structural materials in living things that are made up of proteins assembled from amino acids, and they make up the construction or the shape and mobility of things. So that's one type. A second is the tools and machinery. Those are the enzymes, which are special forms of proteins. So class, stick with me here. These are proteins, so are these. They just have a special name. They're called enzymes. They are proteins that speed up reactions. And they refer to the metabolism or the growth and maintenance of living things. Now the second major type of molecules are called the blueprints. We refer to them as the genes or the nucleic acids. They are the DNA and the RNA of living things. And they refer to the reproduction, the information, and the directive function. Now listen to Dr. Crick. The proteins, because of their versatility and chemical reactivity, do all the work, but are unable to reproduce themselves in any simple way. The nucleic acids, the second class here, seem tailor-made for reproduction, but can achieve rather little else compared to the more elaborate and better equipped proteins. Then he says something very interesting. First of all, let me tell you again, there's two types of proteins, the structural and the enzyme. Let's see what I say next year. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and tell you this piece. The nucleic acids are good for reproduction and not much else. The proteins do all the work. You with me, group? All right, now let's take a little break from what that says. And I want to spend just a few minutes talking to you about proteins. I offer my apology to every protein because we should take 6 months on this. We're going to take 5 minutes. So you're going to listen fast with me. You see these 20 common amino acids up here? I'm going to let you have just a minute to take a good look at those. We'll have a quiz at the end. If you were in my chemistry class, you would memorize those. And not only that, you would memorize the chemical structures that's underneath them. And the reason you would, class, is because each one of those has its own unique chemical structure, which makes it very important as to how it interacts. There's 20 common amino acids. Let me just name a few of them. Glycine, alanine, valine, leucine, isoleucine, proline, serine, threonine, and so on. You'll notice that most of them end with I-N-E, don't they? Not quite all of them, but most of them. All right, have I given you long enough? Y'all know you have those memorized. Extremely important, class, because those 20 common amino acids are what make up every protein in every living thing. In other words, strings of amino acids build proteins. And it's these 20 that make up those strands, one connected to another. Maybe I ought to tell you just this much chemistry. They're called amino acids because every one of them has an NH3 group. That's an amine group. So if you notice their structures, every one of them has one of those NH3 groups in it. They also all have a COO group. That's the acid piece of it. So they're amino acids. Okay? Now, they act very much like the 26 letters of the alphabet. You know that in English you have 26 letters and every word is made up of a combination of those 26 letters, is it not? In protein language, every protein is made up of a combination of those 20 amino acids. Strings of them. But there's a difference. The average word in English has about 5 or 6 letters. The average protein has about 1,000 amino acids in a row. They're huge. But they're made up of these 20. Now, can I take a little break here, class, and tell you what an evolutionist would say about that? Because you need to know how an evolutionist thinks. An evolutionist would say, why is it that all living things on earth have the same chemistry? They would say it's because we all came from a common ancestor in the ocean. And that the first forms of life formed in the ocean out of these chemicals. And then over centuries and millennia of time, they evolved into all living forms. And the reason our chemistry is the same is because we're all in the same family tree. Now, folks, that is not a stupid explanation. That is one perfectly reasonable explanation. So I don't like it when Christians say evolution is so stupid, I don't know why anybody could believe it. There's nothing about it makes any sense. That is not correct. Evolution does give some reasonable explanation for some things. And if you ask me, am I an evolutionist, I say yes and no, like any good politician. I am an evolutionist if you mean do I believe in limited change. I absolutely do. The evidence for that's overwhelming. I am not an evolutionist if you mean all living things share a common ancestry with all other living things. I am not an evolutionist, if that's what you mean. The support is not there for such a theory. So I distinguish between the general theory of evolution and the special theory of evolution. The general theory is not well supported at all. But look, this piece of evidence can be interpreted that way. The reason that we all have the same chemistry is because we all came from the same source. So how does a creationist deal with that evidence? I say, does the Creator have to start over every time He makes something? In fact, if He's going to make something where we all interdepend on one another, don't we need to have a common chemistry? I think that's a sign of design myself. You see? Two different interpretations of the same evidence. All right. That was all thrown in free of charge. We're back to the chemistry. I want you to clearly understand that this statement I'm about to read is a direct quote from Francis Crick. I didn't say this. This is my excuse. Here's what he says. RNA and DNA are the dumb blondes of the biomolecular world, fit mainly for reproduction with a little help from the proteins, but of little use for much really demanding work. Sorry, blondes in this audience, I didn't say that. He said it. But I love to read it because that's the only thing you're going to remember from tonight, or one of the few. But I like it because that's the truth. DNA and RNA are designed for reproduction, but they're not good for doing the other stuff that are required by proteins, that requires proteins to do. And not only that, class, they can't reproduce by themselves. They've got to have proteins to reproduce, as you will see. All right, my treatment of proteins was so pitifully inadequate that I'm almost embarrassed to proceed. But I want to talk to you about this other giant class of molecules called DNA and RNA, because that's what I want to talk about tonight. So here we go. This famous structure discovered by Crick and Watson back in 1953, a changing point in history, ladies and gentlemen, 1953. And here we live in 2013. What's that? 60 years later. In those 60 years, ladies and gentlemen, we have uncovered by God's grace more about how life works than in all the time before together. Utterly amazing. And one of the great discoveries was this one, this characteristic structure, they called it. It's a double helix. You see these strands wrapped around each other with crossbars. And because of that structure, it has the capacity to reproduce itself. That was one of the great breakthroughs by Crick and Watson, based on thousands of hours of work by somebody else. But they did make the breakthrough. And so I need to explain to you just a little bit how DNA works. So look, you see these interwrapping strands here? The fact is that DNA can unzip. You see this piece here? It's come apart. Here's the rest of it over here, but here, this piece of it has been unzipped. And you'll notice that there's a blob right here called RNA polymerase that rides along the DNA strand and helps it unzip. Okay? RNA polymerase, ladies and gentlemen, is a protein. In fact, any word in chemistry that ends in A-S-E is an enzyme. And if you were listening to me before, an enzyme is a protein. Now, I hope it's okay for you to answer out loud. I'm going to ask you to answer some questions. And I'm going to tell you the answer to the question. I'm going to make it really easy on you. In this test, almost every question I ask you, the answer is protein. So you got it, class? Okay. RNA polymerase is a protein. Yes, it is. In fact, it's a glob of proteins. There's several proteins in there. And if you didn't unzip the DNA, there's no way you could reproduce it. So that's a protein that's required to make the DNA unzip. All right, once it unzips, notice then, you've got this side exposed and this side exposed. Now, on this picture, you only have these letters on one side, but they actually occur on both sides. And did you know there was a time in the 1960s and 70s when we thought only one side was copied? Now we know very well that both sides are copied many times. So here's what happens. The DNA unzips, it exposes this side, and then the RNA comes along and makes a copy of what's on the DNA. See this strand right here? That's called RNA. It's messenger RNA, and what it's doing is copying the information on the DNA. And then the RNA, this piece right here, that piece is released out into the cell, and it takes the information somewhere else. Okay? Now, you're with me so far. Good. There's a whole lot more to say about this one slide. Let me show you, for example. You see this right here, there's an A, a C, a G, and a T. If you look all along this strand, you won't see anything but A, C, G, and T. There's only four things. Now, if you were in my chemistry class, you would know the chemical structure, the names of all four of those. Not required tonight. But in the DNA molecule, you have exactly four substances that are in this strand along here in different orders. Look, A, C, G, T, A, G, G, T, A, C, G, T, T, A, C, G, G, C, A, T, so forth. A and C, G and T. So you got four things that are stranded along there that are then copied. And every time you see a C, a G is right across from it. If you see a G, you see a C across from it. If you see a T, an A is across from it. And if you see an A, a U is across from it. You see an RNA, the T is replaced by the U. Don't ask me why. That's another 2 days discussion. But the fact is, C and G match up and A and T match up. Like love and marriage and a horse and carriage. Okay? Now, the strand here has a language in it. That's what we've learned. We've learned that this language is made up of three-letter words. Every word in this language has three letters. So if you take four things, three at a time, how many words can you make, class? If you're allowed repetition. Well, I will tell you. You can make four times four times four words. You want to do the arithmetic in your head? Four times four times four. We're too lazy to do that, aren't we? Because we've got calculators. That's 64. This language has exactly 64 words. Each one of them is three letters long, and they consist of these four letters that you see up here. Now let's proceed. What's interesting is when it's copied, the RNA piece takes that language and carries it off somewhere else and does something with it. Here are the 64 words. And you notice at the side there, this is called the genetic code. We learned the genetic code, ladies and gentlemen, in the 1960s. The late 50s and early 60s, when I was in college. It was an exciting time because we were uncovering all kinds of new stuff. And here's a way to describe it. Think of this as being the first letter in the three-letter word. This is the second letter, and this is the third letter. And with that description, you can get all 64 words. Watch. If the first letter is U, which, by the way, on the DNA is T, isn't it? And the second letter is U, and the third letter is U. That's this piece right here. UUU means phenylalanine. That helpful? Let's try another one. How about UAG? That's that one. That means stop. That's interesting. We'll get back to that in just a minute. How about this one? C-U-U. That's leucine. I'm pausing on purpose. When somebody catches on, will you tell me? Let's try one more. How about A-C-C? That's threonine. You remember we had some words that ended in I and E? Those are the amino acids. Ladies and gentlemen, what you have in the genetic code is a specific code for every one of those 20 amino acids. Now there's 64 words up here. You only have 20 amino acids. So do you see some repeats? Yeah. Because you have 64 words to work with. Well, somebody says, why would you have repeats? Well, I think that's a backup system myself. Kind of like you do in space program. There's a lot of backup systems. But the fact is, in the genetic code, you have codes then for all 20 amino acids. Ladies and gentlemen, are you getting this? Inside the DNA is code for all 20 amino acids. So when you're copying that code, what are you copying? You're copying a code for a strand of DNAs. A strand of amino acids. Now, class, my question is, what's a strand of amino acids? A protein. That's exactly right. So what you have coded in the DNA is the code for building proteins. Amazing. In addition to the code for amino acids, you have a code, AUG, that says, start reading! And then you have another code up here. In fact, you have three of them that say, stop reading. People teach this stuff, ladies and gentlemen, as if, aren't we brilliant for finding it out? And hardly ever give any attention how to get there in the first place. So look, you're reading along the DNA, and you come to the word AUG, and it says, start reading. It also means methionine, which is one of the 20 amino acids. So you start reading and you read methionine. Then you read the next three letters, and maybe that's leucine. You need the next three letters. That's isoleucine. The next three is methionine again. The next three is asparagine, and so on. And you have one three-letter word after another till you, what? Stop! And in between start and stop, you have a string of amino acids. And what is that, class? That's a protein. So when that RNA copies the information and carries it off somewhere, it's carrying the information of how to build a protein. Looks like a design to me. You seriously think nature by itself produced this language? I will guarantee you've received a message from space with just the genetic code in it. Everybody on Earth would say, oh, the stars didn't do that. There's some intelligent civilization out there that sent us that. But with it in every cell and every living thing, people say, isn't it interesting what nature did? It's unbelievable to me. The SETI organization and any other reasonable person would certainly conclude this came from an intelligent source. If I stopped right there, if you were my jury, class, I could close my case. I would say, jury, I have demonstrated to you that living things have a language in them we can decode and read that does stuff. You seriously believe, jury, that that happened by natural causes? If you believe that, you got more faith than all Israel. But we haven't even started. There's so much more to the description of life as we know it than just the genetic code. That's just one tiny piece. There are a million other things going on. I'm not going to tell you a million, but I'm going to tell you a few. Because we need to look at what happens with that code. Look, all we've talked about so far is the DNA up here and making a copy of it. That's called transcription. But after it's transcribed, then the RNA has to migrate outside the nucleus and down here to be picked up by two ducks hugging each other. And it's read like a tape through a tape player, and that's called translation. And out of the bottom comes a protein that's been constructed based on the information. What I've just told you should take 2 years to explain. Because there's so much to do with this. But let's just take a little closer look. Here's the transcription process. Here's the DNA that contains all the information. The dumb blondes, right? and the information is copied. You remember what I told you? What does it take to unzip the DNA? Don't forget the answer. It takes proteins to make it unzip. By the way, I didn't tell you. Have you ever had trouble zipping something up after it's unzipped? I have. It's embarrassing. Did you know there's a special protein to help DNA zip back together again? So it doesn't get tangled up? That's the truth. So that's another protein involved in the process. Okay, so you have it unzipped, you copy it, here's the messenger RNA, then the messenger RNA migrates down here, and it has to be matured. Do you see this? Notice, you see those little white blotches there? Those are called introns. They have to be snipped out and then put back together again until you get a mature messenger RNA. Okay? Now I'm going to say this right now because we're coming back to it later. Here's what an evolutionist says about that. Why would some God make a process where you're copying information so that you have to snip out parts of it? Why wouldn't he just make it so you just copy it and then use it? Looks like a stupid design. And that exact argument has been made by evolutionists. They say that looks like an evolutionary accidental process that just happened, and then they just have to snip out pieces of it. You see, class? Well, the fact is you do have to snip out pieces of it. They're called introns, and you have to mature it, and then it migrates. And we'll come back to that. All right, as it migrates down here, you see that hole right there in the nuclear wall? Do you think any respectable nuclear wall wants just anything passing through it? No. Guess what guards the gate and only allows messenger RNA through and nothing else? A protein. That's exactly right. There's a very specialized protein that sits there and opens when the messenger RNA comes up and closes back up again. So there's another protein, class. That's why I told you, RNA and DNA are dumb blondes. They're not much good for anything but reproduction, but they can't even do that without the proteins. All right, now let's go outside. Do you see the hole right there? Here comes the messenger RNA through that hole, and guess what? There's another protein on this side of it also to guard the hole. And so here comes the messenger RNA, and as I said, it's picked up by two ducks hugging each other. That's really called the ribosomes, and they don't look like ducks. It just makes a nice picture. But it does close in on it like this, and then you see that messenger RNA going through there. It actually does read the code right off of it. And at the bottom, the various amino acids that are required from this code are pieced together by polypeptide bonds into a strand to make a protein. The code's way back up there in the nucleus. The code is transmitted, translated, and used to build a protein. Utterly incredible. And by the way, it makes very few mistakes. Now, there's something else I have to tell you here. You see these little guys over here? Those are called transfer RNAs. Their specific job is to carry amino acids from the cytoplasm over here to build the proteins. You see how it's carrying them? They don't look like that, people. It's a nice picture. But they do carry the amino acids. There's one transfer RNA for each amino acid. That means there's exactly 20 of those, each one unique to its amino acid. And so they bring them in there. They hook them up. Guess what it takes to make them hook up? Exactly right. In addition to that, there's this RNA here that helps form the ribosomes. You see that RNA right there? We haven't even talked about that. I'm only talking about messenger RNA. There's two other types of RNA. Guess where they're coded? Back up in the DNA. Guess what it takes to get the code out? For those also. So please understand that when I get finished tonight, there will be 10,000 things I haven't told you that are going on at the same time, and nobody bumps into each other. Let's stay back here just one more second. How large did I tell you, class, the typical protein is? How many amino acids in a row? 1,000. You know how long it takes to build a protein with 1,000 amino acids in a chain? You watch. That was about 10,000 times too slow. Proteins are built in microseconds, even though they are 1,000 amino acids long, by the process I just told you. They read a three-letter word. They say, go get me a methionine. It comes in, sits there. Then it reads the next three-letter word, go get me an arginine. They bring it in here. Next three-letter word, bring it in here. Next three-letter word, bring it in here. It's like a factory. And it happens in microseconds. And since you've been sitting here listening to me, every cell in your body has been producing proteins at an enormous rate. You wonder why you get tired just sitting there? Your body is busy. Billions of cells building billions of proteins every second. I get tired thinking about it. Okay. No wonder Dr. Carol Haskins said, did the code and the means of translating appear simultaneously in the evolution? Seems almost incredible that any such coincidence could have occurred. Almost. Given the extraordinary complexities of both sides and the requirement they be coordinated accurately for survival by a pre-Darwinian, somebody before Darwin, or a skeptic of evolution after Darwin, and now you're looking at one, this puzzle would surely have been interpreted as the most powerful sort of evidence for special creation, and I so interpret it. I don't believe for one second that method I just described to you could have been happening by natural causes. A language being translated, transcribed, and used to build proteins at an enormous rate, you really believe that came about by natural causes? You have a lot more faith than I do. The DNA contains the code. It takes many proteins to transcribe and translate the code, doesn't it? I mean, I ask you to say that word many times. These proteins are themselves coded in the DNA. Did you realize that? Every protein is coded in the DNA, including the ones that are required to build proteins. To produce these proteins from the code requires the proteins themselves. So which came first? Let's see if you remember, class. You remember when we had the DNA unzipped and there was that glob that rode along it there? I said it was RNA polymerase. You remember this? That's a protein. Guess how you got the first RNA polymerase? It had to be built by the process that requires RNA polymerase. So how do you get the DNA to unzip for the first RNA polymerase when you don't have it? You see? It's a big problem. What makes the origin of life and the genetic code a disturbing riddle is this. The genetic code is without any biological function unless it's translated. That is, unless it leads to the synthesis of proteins whose structure is laid down in the code. But as Monod points out, the machinery by which the cell translated the code consists of at least 50 macromolecular components which are themselves coded in the DNA, and most of those are class proteins. So how'd this ever get started? I say an intelligent designer started it. It has all the features of a designed factory, plus a language. It's the old chicken and the egg problem, only worse. A living cell is a marvel of detailed and complex architecture. I love it. You see who said that? Carl Sagan in 1974. And we've learned so much since 1974, ladies and gentlemen. But then he said it was a detailed and complex architecture. What does that imply, class? An architect. But not according to Carl Sagan. Seen through a microscope, there's an almost appearance of almost frenetic activity. Okay, do you know frenetic? I'll show you. That's frenetic. You look down inside a living cell, it's going crazy in there. On a deeper level, it's known that molecules are being synthesized at an enormous rate on almost any enzyme, which is a what class? Protein, catalyzes the synthesis of more than 100 other molecules per second. Isn't that what I said? In 10 minutes, the sizable fraction of the total mass of a metabolizing bacterial cell can be synthesized. The information content of a simple cell, shame on him for calling it that, has been estimated as around 10 to the 12th bits, comparable to about 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica, which doesn't have many pictures. And that was in 1974. We're 40 years later. And we know 10,000 much more about this than we did then. Over 200,000 molecules being built per second in every cell. Now, class, I've kept you for a while. The next piece of what I'm going to explain to you has been discovered in the last 20 years. What I've just told you, we knew in the 1970s. What I'm about to tell you has been discovered since the 1990s. I need your rapt attention. Some of you are fading out on me. And I can't blame you. If I were sitting, I'd be fading out too. So what we're going to do, class, is for just about a minute, I would like for all of you to stand up and just kind of wiggle a little bit. Get your blood flowing. No fair leaving. And while you do that, I'm not going to waste any time. I want to tell you about another couple of books in case I forget later. This one is called The Language of God by Francis Collins. Francis Collins led the team who completely deciphered the genetic material of humans. You know that they've completely deciphered the genetic material of humans. That happened in 2003. This is a book by him. It's called The Language of God. He is a firm believer in God. Now, he still believes in evolution also. He's a firm believer in God. This one called The Myth of Junk DNA by Jonathan Wells, I will refer to a little bit later. Its copyright date is last year. Very current book. I highly recommend them to you. Now you can sit down. Thank you. Okay. Now, you've seen all this marvelous material I've just showed you, how it testifies to a designer, have you not? So now when we've discovered what DNA is really made of, the whole genome has been mapped as of 2003. And even before that, class, we began mapping pieces of it and began discovering that inside the DNA, there's a whole lot of what looks like useless stuff. And this idea began to develop in the 90s and on up into the 2000s that really only a small piece of DNA is used to do what I just described to you. There's a whole lot of the rest of the DNA that isn't used for that, it appears. So the question came to be, what about the junk that's the rest of it? Only about 5% of the DNA is used for protein building. Now, that fact did not come to light until the 90s and the 2000s. So what about the other 95% of it? And I can tell you when I was first hit with this, I was doing a lecture like this on the campus of the University of South Florida back in the 90s. And I'd given this wonderful display I just showed you. And a professor stood up during the Q&A and he said, "Now, Professor Payne, what you haven't told this group is that all that you've described about the DNA and how it builds proteins only requires 5% of the DNA. The other 95% is pretty well commonly agreed upon to be junk. Why didn't you tell the class about that?" And his comment was, "If you are such a strong believer in God, why would God design something that's 5% useful and 95% junk? Doesn't sound like a very smart God to me." And I can tell you that argument was repeated over and over and over in technical scientific works, as well as in popular works for you to read. And what they said was this: that DNA looks more like a leftover of evolution, where a whole lot of it is just junk, and then there's little pieces of it that actually do something, that evolved, and it clearly shows the remnants of an evolutionary process. And I can tell you that for me in my house, I didn't know what to say about that. I was stumped, because this was new information, ladies and gentlemen. And it was certainly new to me. So, what do you do, Christian? And here's what I want to say to you, class. I'm convinced, and this is one man's opinion, I'm convinced no matter how advanced we get in our understanding of things, there are always going to be things that can throw us for a loop. And I think you're always going to be confronted with difficult things you don't know how to answer. There has never been a generation of mankind where we understood everything. Never. And there have always been things that would throw doubt on your faith. I'm convinced of that. Here was another one. And believe me, this was taught in colleges and high schools. This doesn't testify to some God, and you better get over it if you're a God believer. And I'll tell you secondly what I've learned through my years of study. When you're hit with a wall and you don't know how to deal with that wall that's been put up in front of you, you need to decide, I'm going to be patient and wait about 10 years or 15 years till we uncover what really is happening that looked like an unanswerable argument. And that is precisely what's happened with junk DNA. What was thought for 20 years to be junk, we're just beginning to understand. So while I didn't know how to answer that professor that night, I have learned how to answer. And here's what I say now. I say, sir, please be careful what you call junk. It might be embarrassing later when we finally discover what that junk is doing. Maybe we should say, in our ignorance, we're not yet sure what's going on, rather than calling something junk. Did you know that in the 1800s, a gentleman, a scientist named Weidenreich, said you had 120 vestigial organs in your body? Vestigial, left over from your evolutionary past. You know how many now evolutionists claim you have in your body?
Zero.
Because we've discovered the functions for those supposed vestigial organs. One of them was the appendix. One of them was the bottom of your tailbone. Why do you need that? That's the leftover of when you were a monkey. And lots of other things were said in the 1800s. Give it a while, ladies and gentlemen. And in this case, 20 years is good enough. And this little book, The Myth of Junk DNA, by Jonathan Wells, a very well-respected biochemist and molecular biologist, is full of information about all that 95% up there. We're learning so much more about DNA than we ever dreamed before. So, here's what I'm going to do very quickly. We're going to flash through. There's evidence that suggests that DNA is probably functional. Most non-protein coding DNA is coding into various RNAs. Did we know that before 1990? No. Most of the non-protein coding DNA, that 95%, is coding for various kinds of RNAs that we knew nothing about before. Many non-protein coding DNA sequences are conserved, in other words, from one organism to another, which makes them appear to have a very valuable purpose. We still don't know what it's all for. Evidence for specific biological functions of non-protein coding DNA. The RNAs from this DNA play a significant role in controlling whether, where, and to what extent protein coding regions are transcribed. What we're learning, people, is that 95% is evidently a grand operating system to control the whole process. You know, in your computer, it can't work without an operating system. What we're learning is the rest of that DNA, it appears to be at least in part an operating system that's controlling things. And I'm just getting started. Introns, you remember what those were? Those little chunks I said had to be snipped out and then pieced back together. What we're learning is those introns are not junk. They have all kinds of functions. They're rich in splicing factor recognition sites. In other words, those introns help us decide where to splice. And you know what we've discovered, folks? The same stretch of DNA codes for about 1,000 different proteins because you can snip it different ways. And it's thanks to the introns that a lot of that happens. Imagine a code now that will code for lots of different proteins in the same stretch. So what looked like, that sounds like a stupid design, is in fact a magnificent design that allows much more flexibility than we ever dreamed. The RNAs from introns influence gene expression by modifying chromatin. That's another whole subject. Densely concentrated specified information. There are multiple messages stored in the same sequence. Spliceosomes and editosomes make that happen. Guess what those are? Proteins. Exactly right. There are codes within codes. There's a great example in that little book, The Myth of DNA, of a letter that was written during the Revolutionary War by a mother from home to her husband, who was a military guy. And she told a story in there about how things were at the house. Our children are doing great. They're going to school. We've got crops growing, blah, blah, blah. It's all about farm life. Only problem was, inside of what she wrote was a code that told him where the armies were, where they were moving next, and where all the supplies were. But it was a letter that, if you just read it, was a letter about going home, about how kids were doing. But she built into it a code that if you knew how to read it, you could tell what she really was wanting to get across. Did you know we found that exact same thing in DNA? Now you tell me, class, how natural selection, acting upon natural forces, could build a code inside of a code. Yeah, nature did that, right? There are dual and overlapping messages. That's what we're learning. Pseudogenes. Let me tell you an argument here. Inside DNA, Francis Collins would tell you, we found a stretch of that DNA that looks like the gene for building vitamin C. Did you know your body doesn't produce vitamin C? You have to take it externally. And you better be taking it or you're in trouble. You know you can get a disease and not having enough vitamin C. Your body doesn't build vitamin C. They discovered in our DNA a section of it that looks like the code that builds vitamin C in rabbits. And it still works in rabbits. But in us, it doesn't work. And they say it's because it's been mutated. A little piece of it's been bumped out. So it no longer works. So they call it a pseudogene. Now, how do you answer that, Christian? Here's how an evolutionist answers that. That's a clear illustration of evolution. Something in our DNA used to work when it was in rabbits and in other living creatures. In us, it doesn't work because it was mutated in the process of evolution to us. That's how they explain that. So what do we say about that? You see, one thing I like to do in this series is I like to leave question marks sometimes for you to struggle with. Bible believers, when God told Abraham, you're going to have a son, you and your wife, and here Abraham is, 90 years old, no son. And God said, oh yeah, you're going to have a son. He tried to fix it, right? And boy, did he mess things up. Did he know enough biology to know that he was too old to have a son? And his wife too? But he was asked to trust, wasn't he? I don't believe it'll ever be different than that, folks. There will always be things you have a challenge about understanding. that there's enough powerful evidence for the existence of God and to have faith in Him, you go on anyway. What we found is pseudogenes. Some produce functional proteins, some produce RNAs, some produce RNAs that increase the expression of their corresponding functional genes. The supposed pseudogenes are doing stuff. We don't know all of it yet, but we know enough to know they're not just pseudogenes. There's a bunch of repetitive stuff in the non-protein coding. There are lines, long interspersed nuclear elements. Don't you like that? And then there are short interspersed nuclear elements. That's like stretches of the DNA that seem to have zero purpose, just a bunch of repetition. Looks like a desert. What we're beginning to learn is those things have vital significance in the DNA. They look like just a bunch of junk. And there's endogenous retroviruses. How do you like that one? There's files within folder systems similar to words, sentences, and paragraphs, genes, gene folders, and superfolders, and isocores. Look, there's so much organized information crammed into that DNA. It better be organized or you never get to it. And we're finding out it builds on itself so you can always find what you need. How does your desk look? This one's organized. If we received a message from space, ladies and gentlemen, containing just the genetic code and an explanation of how it's used to build proteins, there isn't anybody that wouldn't say it's an intelligence source. There's 10,000 more things than that going on, and people sit around and say, isn't it wonderful how nature, acting upon the blind forces of physics, produce living things? Which is more reasonable, ladies and gentlemen? I ask you, jury, everywhere we look, from the macroscopic to the microscopic, Behe says they look like they've been made. Richard Dawkins says they may look like that, but they weren't made. They were produced by small steps over millions of years. Which is more reasonable, class? I say there are many reasons for our hope from examining the natural world. We have a great defense we can give by looking at the features of God's other book. That's my lesson for tonight.